Minister Craig Morrow.
Well, thank you, Danielle, for blowing my cover. This is the reading, and then comes the sermon. This is my way of sneaking in a longer sermon, in case anybody hadn't noticed it, by starting in the reading. That's why we always put the readings up on the website as well. But my reading is pretty short today. It's from a package of Beacon Hill chocolate walnut cookies. And for your information, the Unitarian Universalist National Headquarters were once on Beacon Hill. They were there for many, many years. Introducing cookies bursting with chunky, bumpy personality, the Pepperidge Farm American Collection. Only the bakers of Pepperidge Farm could pack so much scrumptious personality into classically American cookies. They make each cookie one of a kind with an individual personality all of its own. So they gave them rugged, irregular shapes, just as if someone had lovingly shaped each cookie by hand. And beneath the mysterious lumps and bumps, they hid oodles of extravagant ingredients, creamy butter, chunks of nuts, or pure, rich chocolate. The American Collection from Pepperidge Farm, the chunky, bumpy cookies simply bursting with personality. Kind of like those pants. Story. I don't want anyone to get the wrong idea before I start. I like Pepperidge Farm cookies very much. For many years, I could be bribed to do certain things to get one, especially in Milano, and I'm not above it now. I'm not here this morning to preach against Pepperidge Farm's cookies or any of their fine baked products. I'm simply intrigued to learn how adding bumps and lumps and texture to a cookie can turn it into something like a person. The label I just read tells us that we are about to open something very much like a package of individual living beings, each with its own unique personality. Although we don't have to worry that any of them will have the personality of a conformist or a wimp. These are rugged, irregular, individualistic cookies. These cookies are true Americans like us. If any of them go out of the country on the export market, we can be sure that they'll do us proud. Now, Deborah will share some life with us through her music. Musical instruments is something that have a life inside of them. But can a cookie become a rugged American by adding the right secret ingredient? The notion that something made by human hands can contain more life than we suppose has an old history, one that goes back to long before the arrival of Europeans in the Americas. In Europe, it's a history that's often far less pleasant than any fairy tales witches brew with eye of newt to help you see or wing of bat to help you fly and so on. Have you ever heard of the legend of the golem? There are many variations on the story, but the basic ingredients are generally the same. A Christian child has gone missing in a European city, and the only possible rational explanation is what? Of course, the Jews of the ghetto have killed the child to use his or her blood as the secret ingredient in their Passover matzahs. Right? Just last night, someone's vandalizing and putting anti-Semitic graffiti. This hasn't gone away. But because they did not accept the original blood sacrifice of Jesus, Jews were cursed with hidden wounds that bleed constantly. They have tried ever since to compensate for this blood loss by sacrificing Christian children and taking their blood. This bizarre accusation is known as the blood libel, and it has reared its ugly head time and time again, like the Black Plague used to do. It rests on a fantasy about secret ingredients. In this fantasy, the secret ingredient which distinguishes Christianity from its very close cousin Judaism is the body and blood of a crucified and resurrected Jewish boy, which are supposed to be present in the flat bread of the Holy Host and the red communion wine. So flip this one around, and the secret ingredient of the flat bread of Passover must be the blood of a Christian child. Compounding this fantasy is the fact that Passover and Easter often come so close together. The golden legend starts with this bumpy, nutty logic of secret ingredients and takes it in a new direction. The real child murderer in the golem stories is always nominally a Christian himself, an evil magician who schemes against the Jews. He has used the child's blood in a magic potion to give himself power, and at the same time, he hopes to pin the blame on the Jewish minority. But then, an old rabbi learns of the plot from a mysterious night visitor. The rabbi must act before the sorcerer has had time to arouse enough fear and anger to provoke yet another pogrom against the Jews in the ghetto. Now here's an excerpt from one version of the story in which Rabbi Leib of Prague asks his night visitor what he should do to help his people in this awful situation. "Make a golem, and he will save you." "A golem? How? From what?" "From clay. You will engrave one of God's names on the golem's forehead, and with the power of that sacred name, he will live for a time to do his mission." "What sacred name shall I engrave?" Rabbi Leib asked. The stranger took out from his breast pocket a piece of chalk, and on the cover of Rabbi Leib's prayer book, wrote down some Hebrew letters. Then he said, "I must go now. See to it that all this remains a secret, and employ the golem only to help the Jews." In Hebrew, golem means a shapeless thing, but this golem isn't shapeless. The rabbi brings clay to his attic and he works it into human form. Then he writes the secret name of God across the clay figure's forehead. As he finishes the last letter, the giant comes to life, stands up, ready to be commanded. In this case, the secret ingredient that brings something to life is a name. You can hear in this tale an echo of the story in the book of Genesis about how God shapes the first human being from the dust of the earth and breathes into its nostrils the breath of life, God's own breath. In the golem story, the rabbi uses a secret name of God, and one storyteller informs us that this name, quote, "holds the power at the source of all being." That's some secret ingredient, enough to make Pepperidge Farm jealous. But you want to know the word that the rabbi wrote on the clay man's head so you can go try this at home? Maybe on some cookie dough? I have to warn you, though, that in most versions of the story, having a golem proves to be a mixed blessing. Yes, it does help the rabbi to expose the real murder of the Christian child and prevent a pogrom. But then the rabbi is reluctant to give up the golem, and he keeps it as a servant. Soon it begins to demand the privileges of a real human being, and then it develops a passionate desire for a maidservant in the rabbi's home. Whoops! There's more life in this clay man than the rabbi intended, and it's life he can't control. When he at last erases the secret name from the golem's forehead, he frets that he might be committing murder. So, if you're hoping that I'll share the secret name of God with you today, so you can go home and make a golem of your own to take care of household chores, I'll have to disappoint you. I don't know the secret name of God. What's more, I believe there is no secret name of God that will bring things to life that don't already have it in them. I don't think that there are any religious secrets, or at least none that really matter. When it comes to religion, words that are clear and simple are the ones that really count. I want to return now from the Near East and Europe to North America again, the land of rugged men and cookies, and share with you some words that were recorded by the linguist Jaime de Angulo. He studied and lived among the Native Americans of Northern California during the first half of the 20th century. Spent a great deal of time there among the people known as the Pitt River Indians, making many close friends and learning their language. One day, he was deep in conversation with a Pitt River friend who'd been explaining how two beings called Coyote and Silver Fox created the world, not by words, not by talking, by a lot of singing and dancing and stomping around to stretch things out, sort of like working dough. The linguist thought, though, that he'd heard a contradiction in the story, just as Bill, his native friend, finished telling it. So he asked if, after all that stomping and stretching, didn't they make people too? No, not people, not Indians. The Indians came later, but that's a long story. I'll tell you someday. All right, Bill, but just tell me one thing now. There was a world now. There were a lot of animals living on it, but there were no people then. What do you mean there were no people? Ain't animals people? Yes, they are, but they're not Indians, but they're people. They're alive. What do you mean animal? Well, how do you say animal in Pitt River? I don't know, but suppose you wanted to say it. Well, I guess I'd say something like, Te pade wade tolo akazi, world over, all living. I guess that means animals, Doc. I don't see how, Bill. That means people also. People are living, aren't they? Sure they are. That's what I've been telling you. Everything is living, even the rocks, even that bench you're sitting on. Somebody made that bench for a purpose, didn't he? Well, then it's alive, isn't it? Everything is alive. That's what we Indians believe. White people think everything is dead. We can see that Doc has touched a nerve in his friend Bill. And what Bill says about how white people think may touch a nerve in us. I don't have to tell you how much Bill and his people were hurt by the white newcomers. And no one had to explain to Bill that it had less to do with skin color than a worldview, a way of seeing and touching things that was radically different from the Pitt River way. That bench you're sitting on, somebody made that bench for a purpose, didn't he? Well, then it's alive, isn't it? What's Bill asking Doc to try to understand here? Is he trying to get his white friend to believe something silly or primitive or crazy about some kind of life in a bench of all things? To get at what Bill was saying to Doc about the bench, let's start like he did, with what we're sitting on. Let's try a simple experiment. Will you rise as you are able? Remember, I warned you before about enjoying making people sit and stand. Now, as you stand or sit, if you're more comfortable, very straight, try to imagine that your feet are pressing into the body of something that's alive. Try to feel your naked foot inside your sock, inside your shoe. Feel first one, then two, Maybe they're pressing on either side of the living creature's backbone. How can you adjust your stance so that it would feel good to that creature? Maybe it would like a little pressure right there. Yeah. Ooh, a little more on the left. Now right. Now some heel. Now some toe. Some more heel. Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, that's good. Now, please sit down again. And do the same thing with your sit bones on your living seat. Try a little more hip on this side and on that one. Same thing, as if that chair is alive. Good. Could Bill have been onto something when he spoke of Doc's bench as alive? Do you feel more alive when you act for just a moment as if your surroundings might be alive too? You've probably picked up your order of service again. Try holding it very lightly, like it was a butterfly that might fly away. Look at it. Carefully. Is it shaking a little bit with your pulse or your breathing? Can you hold it as if it were alive? It's just a piece of paper. It has no organs, certainly. It may not be true in every way you can think of to call it alive. But it would be false in almost every way to say that it's dead. Someone made it for a purpose. Someone cut the living tree and others processed it into paper. The language on it represents hundreds of thousands of years of human development, layers and layers of techniques discovered, discoveries that would take thousands of pages to describe in full detail. Honestly, if you worked for the rest of your life, could you make another one like it? Paper, print, and all. Look on the back of it where it says, "The living tradition which we share draws from many sources and tells us that the first of these is direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life." You don't need to invoke anything supernatural to experience it. The natural and the human are mysterious and wonderful and alive enough. It's right here in our hands, the product of so many lives and so many purposes coming together in a folded sheet of paper that we can only wonder at it. I don't have to tell you that someone arranged for this place and put these seats and lights and pieces of paper in it for a purpose. They did. You did. You may be thinking, but that doesn't make this place alive. The only life in the floor and the chairs and the surrounding walls is the life that we put into it, that we share with it for a time. And that, of course, is the whole point of the experiment that we just did. And the whole purpose of worship itself, to share life in a commingling of song and breath, story, and spirit. And the life we share is the only life we have as a worshiping community. Sometimes we just have to proclaim such good news openly. The life we share is the only life we have, heart and soul. Soon, you'll be hearing from members of our stewardship team. They won't be asking much of you, just your life. They'll be inviting you to share a generous portion of your life in the form of your pledge. They don't mean to devalue the time that you share here already, or to say that service matters less than money. They understand that your money is also your time and your service, compressed and expressed on paper. A very real portion of your very real life and love and labor. They'll be reminding you that this house, which you are making for a purpose, has grown and is about to grow more as a natural expression of its good health and vitality. Living things don't like to be cramped by inadequate space or inadequate budgets. They need room to stretch and expand and some good sweet air. If you look again at the back of your order of service, you'll notice that there's nothing about money in our UU principles. That's not because the need for your financial support is a secret. Instead, it's a very important choice that we've made in our religious movement. We've chosen not to write in pledging as an article of faith, nor to leave it to assumption. We want to be sure that there's no way to mistake the living nature of your stewardship contributions. So the reminder is always made by a living, breathing person. We think that's much better than a rule or an assumption about tithing. We have faith that you'll do what you can to help this house, our house built in eternity. Our house built in eternity. To live, to thrive, and not just survive. We know that the life you give will come back to you in countless ways, heart and soul. We hope that's no secret to anybody. We know that stewardship means something different to each of you rugged individuals. But we trust that the experience will be sweet for everyone. Sweeter than a Pepperidge Farm cookie. And maybe twice as bumpy. So may it be.
Good morning. My name is Bruce McPherson, and it is my honor to be the moderator of your Board of Trustees. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Martin Luther King spoke these powerful words in 1964. He derived them from the writings of Theodore Parker, a Unitarian minister and abolitionist in 1853. I believe the statement to be true and take some comfort from it, but it begs a question. Why and how does the moral universe bend toward justice? I believe it has bent and will bend toward justice, partly because Unitarian Universalists have banded together here at Y East to nourish ourselves spiritually and make the world a better place. It is no secret that our liberal Unitarian Universalist values are currently under attack. With the election of our current president, fair and equal treatment of women, minorities, and the LGBTQ community are in danger. Our religious liberties are in question. I believe our community, our state, and our nation needs a strong Y East as a bulwark against these dark forces. Today is the start of the canvas season, and we must talk about money. Before doing so, I would like to acknowledge that money is not the only way that you give to Y East. You give generously of your time through programs such as the monthly homeless dinner and the Social Justice Committee. This can be tiring work, and I thank you for it. As with any church, A component of YA's strength comes from our budget. Last year, we approved a budget that was aspirational. We knew we wanted our new minister to be half-time. We knew we wanted to pay him a fair wage and benefits for his efforts. We were optimistic that he would attract new members and help lead us into a bold future. After just a year of Craig in our pulpit, our optimism has been rewarded. As we knew when we approved it, our current budget is running a deficit. We have savings, but whereas our Board of Trustees was comfortable running a large deficit this year, we are not so comfortable in such a deficit next year. With that in mind, please consider increasing your pledge for the coming church year. We have our own personal budgets to manage, and you know best what pledge is possible. I suggest that you use the words of our own Toad Ocean as a guiding principle. Give until it feels good. We have important work to do. Let us strengthen YEAST and together bend the arc of the moral universe toward justice.
Thank you, Bruce. Hello, I'm Harold McNairn. I am on the Canvas Committee or the Pledge Drive team, whatever you want to call it. As he mentioned, we're starting today the pledge drive, and I want to share just a brief story about why I am a pledging member here at YEAST. I'm originally from Atlanta, Georgia, and in 2011, I decided to move out here to go to grad school at Portland State. And I was very involved with the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Atlanta, which is the largest one in the Atlanta area, and was involved in a very similar group to the Social Justice Committee there. We gave away one Sunday a month, we gave away money to a local nonprofit or advocacy group. And so I wanted to, before I moved, figure out, okay, well, let me look into this. Like, what is a UU picture in Portland? So in doing so, I used Google and tried to figure out which congregations were around, and I discovered there's a number of options here in Portland. I reached out to a couple of congregations, churches, via email, and specifically asked, what kind of social justice work are y'all doing? What are you working on? And a larger congregation never got back to me, but this one, I heard back almost immediately from one Mark Alter, who wrote me a 5-page email all of the things that YEAST had done over the last about 8 years, all of the nonprofits that they had given to, all of the volunteer projects, and I was like, whoa, I need to check this place out. So I still, when I got here, I visited a couple of different congregations, but another part of me, I'm a former nonprofit worker, and I really dig the fact that we share space with a community center, a senior center. We don't take up our own space. It's like really sustainable and fits my values. So yeah, just for like all those reasons, I found a home here. You may not have seen me much because I come like once a month. That's just how I do. I can't, time and all the other things I'm doing. But I found a home here. I found a spiritual home and a root, and it moves me. So thank you all for your part in creating YEAST in that way. And thanks, MA. Pretty awesome. Yeah, shout out.